Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho, the formerly incarcerated one. Among other things, I am currently a freelance writer, criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Joel?
Hi there, I'm Joel Barson. My background is in affordable and supportive housing, and I'm also a friend of Josh.
Thank goodness for that, or this would be a very monologue-driven podcast.
It's been a privilege to be part of this, Josh, from the beginning.
Also, great to work with you, Joel. And so today we're talking about the National Day of Empathy, which is technically the day that we're going to be releasing this podcast is March 6th, which is the Day of Empathy, but we're recording it a few days ahead before that.
So what is it?
The Day of Empathy is a national day where formerly incarcerated and justice-impacted individuals take the lead in calling for legislative and administrative criminal justice reform. It's currently has over 40 states that participate. It was created by the Van Jones Organization Cut 50, which stands for cutting mass incarceration by 50% by the year 2020. But two of the organizations I'm affiliated with, Nation Outside and the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency, are both co-sponsors of the Day of Empathy event in Michigan. And after I put this out on Tuesday, I'll be leading groups of impacted people to meet with legislators all day in Lansing, Michigan on the 6th.
Wow, that's excellent. How many people are going to be with you in those meetings on the 6th?
Well, last year we probably had about 200 people who were impacted that were there. So it was, people who had been incarcerated and were out, and their family members and friends or allies and things like that. And so depending on where you lived determines which group you would go with. And so I'll go see mostly I'll go lead groups that are seeing representatives or senators that are in my area. A lot of times we don't have enough people to cover all the areas, so you do double and triple duty, but I'll take people to see their representatives to talk about whatever impacts them.
And in past years, have Michigan legislators made themselves available? Have they opened their offices? Have they acknowledged the day?
Yeah, last year I probably met with 5 different legislators with probably about 40 different people who came with me to meet with the legislators. And the reason we have a lead is it's usually better to have someone who has some experience with dealing with legislators to kind of help facilitate the interaction between the legislators and the people who are impacted.
Wow. Well, that makes sense. So this year, the National Day of Empathy is organized around 2 main reform efforts, right?
Yeah, that's true. This year, the 2 main efforts are the Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act and the passage of what's called Clean Slate legislation.
Okay, and so those will be the main themes that you and everyone you're sort of shepherding through this process will be bringing up with legislators?
We'll also, every group you meet with, we'll talk about the issues that are particularly important to the people in that group, but those are kind of just like focus issues that we want to raise in addition. One of the reasons, when we talk about, for instance, the Dignity Act, which we'll talk about a lot in just a second, it's national legislation, but the intention is for it to be modeled on the state and local levels as well. And so we'll raise the idea of making it, or at least parts of it, that apply to our state legislation in the state. And I say that because we're unique in Michigan because we have the head of our Department of Corrections is a woman. And so a lot of the reforms that are needed pretty desperately in other states aren't needed as much in Michigan because they've made a lot of those reforms on an administrative level. Unfortunately, that's not always true in jails. So we'll still be pushing for a lot of the dignity stuff in our jails, our county jails.
And before we unpack these issues, have your efforts in previous years yielded dividends? Have there been results? Have you seen fruits from those visits and time spent with legislators?
Yeah, one of the things that we pushed very hard for last year was this, there was a bill in Michigan that the point of the bill was to allow the Department of Corrections to hire formerly incarcerated people again. Many years ago, there had been a long period where formerly incarcerated people were even hired as correctional officers in a lot of the facilities. And the evidence during that period suggested that it had gone very well. But during the worst period of the tough on crime stuff in Michigan, they passed legislation that banned the MDOC from hiring formerly incarcerated people, not based on evidence from anything we could tell. And I've gone back and looked through all the testimony and all of the people who testified for and against. And I haven't seen any evidence that suggested that there was a real problem going on with that. And the point of this new legislation wasn't to start hiring people as correctional officers, but it was to, and we'll actually talk about this a little bit more later, but it was to allow formerly incarcerated people to mentor people on the inside, especially as they were preparing for reentry. And so that was something we pushed very hard for, and it passed this year and got signed by the governor. So it's now law.
That's amazing. Well, thank you for that, Josh. So can you tell us about the Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act and take us through why that is important and some background?
Sure. You know, I mean, to now, the first seven episodes that we've done, with the exception of the interview with Lauren Brooke Eisen, we're really kind of going through everything that happens before you go to prisons and jail. In other words, before you've been sentenced. And now we're starting to move into the period where we're starting to deal with jail and prison reform itself. Not just the preambles. And, you know, once we get through all the stuff about jails and prisons, we'll then talk a lot about reentry. And then I think we'll probably move on to like issues of the day. But one of the things I really wanted to make sure, and there's kind of a longer story to this, you know, when I first got out, I was looking for a vehicle to write about because I wanted to be able to share a lot of my experiences of what I'd seen inside, not necessarily things that had happened directly to me, although some of them are, because I was really pretty lucky and I got through my 3 years without really personally being subject to many, at least not much violence. But I certainly saw a lot of things, and a lot of the anecdotes that I've given throughout the first seven episodes are based in my firsthand experience seeing what's happened to a lot of other people. And one of the things that really motivates me to do this kind of work, to do criminal justice reform work, is to hopefully be a voice for the people inside who don't have a voice, and to try to fight for the people that I met inside and the people that I know outside. And we're all fighting for a better kind of model for the criminal justice system, because we've all seen things that, you know, we really don't think that work very well, and certainly don't result in very good outcomes. And so what I went back through a lot of the prison shows, and a lot of them are very hard to watch if you've been in prison for a number of reasons. But one of them is that they're very, you know, a lot of them emphasize a lot of the wrong, you know, what they show isn't accurate is one problem. Another problem is it can cause a lot of PTSD. You know, you see a lot of things that actually happen, and they really tend to emphasize the violence in prison, which certainly exists, but that's not necessarily very easy to watch if you've been around a lot of it. And so, you know, finally, I just decided, you know, I found that the show that I found that I decided to write about was Orange is the New Black. And the reason that I decided to write about it is because it was really the only show where the premise of the entire show is that everybody, regardless of what they'd done, was a human being and should be treated with dignity.
Yeah.
And as most people who are listening know, that this is a, you know, that's a show about a federal women's facility, low level, what they call a camp. And so I started writing about that show, and, you know, now actually I've written a recap of all 65 episodes. It's something that I've become pretty passionate about over a long period of time. But one of the things I realized very early on is that I personally I knew a lot about the prison, the kind of way prisons are run. I knew a lot about how correctional officers work. I know a lot about how prison in general works, but I obviously was not in a women's facility. And so what that started to do was get me to reach out to a lot. Well, and I'd also met some women who had done time through the reform work that I do. And so I started to have these discussions with them. And one thing that became very obvious to me through this whole process is that when we talk about criminal justice reform in the United States, we often erase the differences between men and women's, and we push for, when we say we're pushing for general criminal justice reform, what we almost always mean is that we're pushing for criminal justice reform for men. And so it was really important to me that when we start this, that we would start with talking about at least some of the issues that are different and that face women in our correctional facilities, so that we don't erase that or make that invisible.
Hear, hear. I'm so glad we're doing that. I love your writing, Josh, and I've read many of your recaps of Orange is the New Black, and those are some of my favorite pieces of your writing. I have found each of those to be illuminating, both in terms of helping me to understand the show a little better, but in the way you've helped me to learn about the prison experience through them. So thank you for what you've put out there. It's amazing.
Yeah, thanks. It really was a passion project. I worked on it for a really long time. And obviously writing 65 full recaps of anything is interesting, but I learned an awful lot and I communicated. What ended up happening is a lot of people would write me about, you know, people who were just out there reading would write me and just tell me how much it meant to them to have someone speaking about those issues. And one of the things for the last at least 6 months that I've kept in there every single month, every single week, till I finished, was writing about the Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act, which is what we're going to talk about for most of today's episode.
Yeah, and, so this is a great convergence of your passions and this issue.
Yeah, so, you know, up front, it's important to know that in most states, there's really usually much less space for women. For instance, in Michigan, despite the fact that the largest, actually across the nation, the fastest growing population of incarcerated people is women. Oh. And so, you know, in Michigan, we have one facility.
Really?
For women out of all the, you know, 30 or whatever it is facilities that we have. It's hard to keep up with which ones have closed and which ones are still open. But so there's much less you know, so what do you think that would, you know, having one facility and the fastest growing population is women, what would you think would be the result of that?
Overcrowding.
Yeah, that's a pretty good guess there, yeah. Joel. It's overcrowding. And it's, you know, it's, so that starts out, you're in a situation that's really rife for a lot of problems.
I remember you talking in past episodes about how crowded environments lead to greater tension and stress and even violence, right?
Yes, it's definitely true. You know, I spent most of my time in what's called a pole barn, which, you know, that means you have 160 people in one basic big building with a bunch of bunk beds. And so, you know, that kind of crowding can really, you get that many people really close together, it can be a recipe for disaster in a million ways. But that's definitely even more of a problem right now in women's facilities. So the first thing we need to, I guess the first thing is that the most prominent federal legislative response so far has been what's called the Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act, which was introduced by Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren, and had Kamala Harris also as a co-sponsor. The Dignity Act had two major parts. The first is things that tries to do for parents, especially mothers, in prison. And the second is things to do for women in prison in general. So we're going to start with parenting first.
Okay, so take us through that one.
Okay. So the first thing is, you know, the Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act tries to keep imprisoned parents of children placed as close to their kids as possible. For those not familiar with the placement problems, in Michigan, for instance, we have prisons all over the state. Many of the prisons are what we would call in Michigan over the bridge, which means that they're close to what we call the Upper Peninsula, which is a pretty far, you know, if you're from Detroit, that's a pretty far way away. You know, some people have, you know, can be as far as, you know, 10 hours away from where they're housed or where they come from. So, you know, a couple of anecdotes. When I was housed in St. Louis, Michigan, when I was incarcerated there, I had friends that would come visit me. And this is a, you know, like I said, some people have to go much farther than this. But the people would come visit me. It would take them 2 hours to get there from, you know, from where I was at. And then they have to be searched and a lot of other stuff. And then they have to wait through a bunch of kind of administrative stuff. And then finally they got to visit me, and then they have to go through the same procedure on the way out. If you think of that, that's, you know, even in a 2-hour drive, that's almost your whole day has been taken up. And how often do you really have a whole day to, you know, I don't know. You said you've visited people before. I don't know what your experience was like.
Yeah. So when I've done it, it's been in the context of work. And so it hasn't been quite the same, but it sounds like a burden, and like it creates a barrier for connecting with those who care about you and those who you care about and from whom I would guess that you would draw strength and support and consolation and connection, and it just seems unfair.
Yeah, and you know, I asked a friend of mine to tell me about her, because she has a son who lives over the bridge. Which again means far, long way away from where we live, which is, you know, in the kind of Detroit-ish area, all the way to the Upper Peninsula. And so this is what she sent me back. And both her and her husband go see their son on a weekly basis. So here's what she said. She said, last weekend it took us 7 hours to get there with 4 stops and 9 hours to get back with 2 stops. And there was a bridge closure delay. Weather, of course, makes a big difference. If anyone, and I know a lot of people living here listening to this probably don't know, but Michigan has crazy weather.
Yeah.
Just this week, we had about 4 days of spring weather, followed by a gigantic snowstorm. And then today, we had great weather again.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I mean,
it's crazy.
It is crazy. And I guess they had some kind of crazy wind problem and they couldn't. So anyway, she says that weather, of course, makes a big difference. And for 5 months of the year, it's a huge issue. They've raised the speed limit in the UP recently to 65 miles per hour, so that helps. But since visiting hours are only from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m., in the evenings we try to leave our house by 8:30 a.m., allowing for unforeseen snags along the way. The last time we went up, we got caught up in a bottleneck right away on 23 as they had construction projects underway. I guess if I had to average it, I would say about 7.5 hours, but most of that was before they raised the speed limit. So, you know, I mean, for parents or for family members, this is a huge burden. And so if there isn't good visitation times, and if there aren't good hours for visitation or days for visitation, that can be a huge thing. So the first thing the Dignity Act does, especially for parents of children, is try to create more consistent visiting times and visiting days. It tries to extend it to at least 6 days a week and 8 hours per visit. So that's a good one. I think that's a good part of it.
Yeah, I mean, you would think it would be in the interest of everyone to want to encourage these connections. It could only, you would think, create more stable, maybe slightly happier incarcerated individuals.
Well, and research shows that when you have more connection back to your community or to your family, you generally have more hope, which means that you participate in prison in a much better way than if you don't. So the results tend to be better, as we almost always focus on this. So it is very important to create this. Another thing that the Dignity Act does is relax contact rules. What that mean? I mean, I remember from my time that you weren't really allowed to touch each other at all when mm-hmm. people visited you. Mm-hmm. Now, most of the people who were visiting me were friends, so that wasn't a big deal.
Yeah.
We might bump fists or something on the way out. But when you're having your child visit you or your parents visit you, you know, I mean, they're already going to be in a pretty emotionally distraught state a lot of the time. And you're going to be in an emotionally distraught state. You might, obviously when you're in prison or jail, you learn to hide that, but that doesn't mean you're not feeling it. And so not being able to have contact, you know,
seems positively inhumane.
Yeah, it's very, very, very bad. And so one of the things the Dignity Act is relax the contact rules, especially for parents, based on only those contact to reduce them to only those contacts that would be an immediate danger. Obviously the reason why contact is limited is because the theory has always been that visitation is the main vector through which drugs and other things come into the prison. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, there's obviously a huge dispute on this between people who've been in prison and people who haven't. I'm not saying it never happens,
yeah.
But in my experience, the main vector through which any contraband gets into the prison is the correctional officers, not the the visitors. That's not to say it never happens, but I mean, look, I had visitors, and every time you have a visitor, you have to go through a full body strip search. Okay, which means that you have to go through all kinds of humiliating things. It's not just taking off your clothes. I don't want to go into too much detail, but you have an officer right there. They tell you to do a bunch of things. Have you ever heard have you ever seen anything like that? It is actually very much like that.
Okay.
I don't want to go into the graphic details, but it's very humiliating. That's very thorough. And so the idea that you're either on the way in or on the way out, getting away with contraband. Yeah, I guess it theoretically it could happen. You could swallow something or whatever, but there's way too much stuff in prison for it all to come through visitation is the main thing I would say.
Wow. What about parenting classes?
Another thing the Dignity Act asks is that all people who are parents have parenting classes made available to them. Which I think is a really good idea, especially if if part of their struggles are with coping with the lack of being able to parent their children, and then being prepared to parent their children when they get back out. But the Dignity Act also kind of goes farther. As I mentioned before, it's not just these kind of larger parental protections. It's also protections for women.
Right. So is this where we get into things like hygiene and shackling and those areas?
Yes. So, I mean, the first one is, unfortunately, a lot of women who are arrested, especially taken to jails, are pregnant. And, the Dignity Act is written so that at least in the, it's mostly the Dignity Act was written for the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which means it probably isn't going to help a lot of people in jails. But like I said before, whenever there is that case, it's still a great protection. And the idea of the legislation is also to form a model for state and local, either administrative or legislative solutions to the same problems.
Right.
So it's a good idea to have a lot of these protections for people who are pregnant, which is kind of the first category. One of the protections prevents pregnant inmates from being placed in segregated housing, which you probably know more as solitary confinement.
Right.
You're already in a pretty emotionally vulnerable state.
I think you touched on this maybe, was it episode one, where you described your day in segregated housing?
Yes. That was definitely not my favorite part of my incarceration. If there is such a thing as a favorite day in incarceration, that was definitely not it.
And the idea that a pregnant woman would be placed into that situation seems abhorrent to anybody's conscience.
Yeah, and the other thing it prevents is the shackling of pregnant inmates, which is something that happens, unfortunately. If you're, for whatever reason, they decide that you're a disciplinary problem or whatever, the first step is usually to shackle someone, and obviously someone who's pregnant, those shackles can be particularly uncomfortable. There are certainly other ways to deal with a problem like that.
And then we move on to the hygiene products that make it a more... really are essential.
Yeah, this is probably one of the biggest obvious differences between men's and women's facilities is that there are certain feminine hygiene products that, men obviously don't need.
Right.
The idea that, for instance, for a very long time, until very recently, most jurisdictions didn't even think about this, was making sure that tampons, sanitary napkins were available for free.
It's unbelievable that those would not be made available just generally to all women who are incarcerated.
Yeah, and just in case people haven't, don't understand the whole way all of this works, if you're in the main way that you get goods in prison or jail is by paying for them. You get a commissary list and you're able to, if you have money in your account, purchase things off the commissary list. But if you don't have any money in your account, then you can't purchase things. And, obviously if you're going to have a period, every month, then you're going to need some stuff to deal with that. And, if you're not, you get paid pennies an hour and the cost of the products is higher than, you know, I mean, you have to work quite a bit to be able to pay that off, and all that means all your commissary would go to things that.
It's frankly, it's impossible for me to imagine. I like, in my mind, I can't conjure up a reason why a lawmaker, for instance, would not want to agree to that.
You would think that would be, yeah, that's one of the ones you would think would be, especially, you know, I mean, at the jail level, when you think, we've talked about this so often before, but a very large percentage of the people in jail haven't been adjudicated guilty of anything.
Right.
And the idea that you would be prevented from, you know, basic
personal care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When we call it the Dignity Act, I think that's why that has a lot to do with. And, you know, at the federal level in federal prisons, this still isn't really dealt with. And that's why the Dignity Act exists. Earlier this year, the Federal Bureau of Prisons put out a memo where they suggested that they were saying that it is policy now for them to make those products available. And when asked, they'll say that they're fulfilling that memo, but no one has been able to verify it. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence from the people inside that suggests that they're not meeting their obligations. And so this is something that's, you know, I know I asked Debbie Stabenow the last time she was here to look into it, because the Federal Bureau of Prisons has been so kind of, I can't think of a better word than shady about this. And so,
what a ridiculous thing to be that way about. Did you, was there any feedback from Debbie Stabenow's office or otherwise?
They basically confirmed that the Federal Bureau of Prisons really isn't being very transparent about this.
Yeah.
And since then, there's been some reporting that suggests that it's very uneven. So we still very much need the Dignity Act to pass for this and a million other reasons. But
yeah. And some of those reasons also get into areas related to showers and bathrooms. Is that right?
Yeah, and access to a gynecologist.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, medical care, we'll have probably a whole episode on that at some point, but it's not very good, as you might imagine. Usually it's privatized and very limited, and obviously there's another area where women's needs are different, and you know, there needs to be gynecological access. But yeah, there's also for a long time been all kinds of, they've mostly gotten rid of what are called body cavity searches. That's not always the case, but they've mostly gotten rid of them. But they still, a lot of times, have opposite sex officers doing strip searches.
That still happens?
Yes. And even after the Dignity Act, it would still probably happen, because, you know, the prisons will always say that there are certain times when, you know, the right officer isn't around and there's an emergency, and so they need to have an option.
Right.
I personally think they should just always make sure they staff the right amount of people, but, that's... but you still have that, and you still have, you know, sometimes you can have officers have to be in the restrooms or something, and you don't want to have an opposite sex officer in your restroom, but,
right.
You know, that's one of the things that the Dignity Act deals with. There's also been problems with, like, sometimes pregnant women getting access to substance abuse treatment, and so the Dignity Act deals with that. And I think this is a really important one. It provides or mandates that there's continuing education for correctional officers and staff with regard to trauma training. Now, generally, my experience with this is more in the mental health training side, mm-hmm. but I think it's a really good idea for both. You know, so much of cycles of violence start with trauma and are grounded in trauma. And so a lot of the reason people become violent starts with violence that's happened to them. A lot of times people who are accused or sentenced or convicted of violent crimes had a lot of violence done to them often when they were kids.
I'm fortunate enough to work for an organization that does take this seriously, and in a couple of weeks I'm going to be going to a 3-day training on trauma-informed care. So
awesome.
Yeah. It makes all the sense in the world that correctional officers and staff should be well-versed in that.
Yeah, this next one's kind of a personal one for me, too. It makes the Dignity Act asks that formerly incarcerated people be allowed to serve as mentors and help with encouragement and preparation for reentry. And this is really personal to me, because when I got out of prison, actually, before I was in prison, before I got sentenced, my therapist suggested that I get together with this guy who had just gotten out for a similar crime and was doing really well. He'd readjusted well and was earning a good living and had actually gotten married and wow. was really, and he was a great guy and we had a great time. And I learned a lot about how to survive in prison and how then, you know, he just was a really good mentor to me
yeah.
on the way into jail and prison.
What a gift.
Yeah. Unfortunately, once I got to prison, I was not allowed to communicate with him.
Oh.
And when I was getting out, I was not allowed to communicate with him, even though he was still successful and still doing really well. And so it's so important, you know, it's very hard, especially when you're, you know, there is a feeling among a lot of inmates that they can't trust people who don't understand having been incarcerated. And the idea that you would shut them off from, you know, the people who have been successful in reentry,
right?
I kind of get where they're coming from, but it just isn't the way. It just doesn't work as well.
Yeah,
it's really important to have mentors who have been through incarceration and have come out on the other end and reconnected to society in a good way.
I feel like I have personally benefited from the insight and wisdom and sharing and openness and vulnerability of formerly incarcerated persons that I've known. And to think that I've had access to that type of contact and that type of sharing and what I've taken from it, but a person who would have much more of a critical need, someone who really needs that sort of mentor in their life, would be denied that. It just seems like yet another way that the situation is being radically unfair and making things that much harder.
Yeah. And so, unfortunately, and this is part of the reason we're doing this cast, there's a couple of... I want to talk about one other thing, but I do want to make this clear before we move on. One of the real problems with the Dignity Act, which seems like, you know, pretty sensible all the way around. There may be some things that get negotiated in or out or whatever, but on the whole, it seems like a pretty great idea to me.
Sure,
you know?
Does. Yeah.
But unfortunately, it has not even gotten a debate in Chuck Grassley's committee. And so one of the things that we're really pushing for is for everybody who's listening to call or write their congressperson and ask them why Chuck Grassley isn't allowing the Dignity Act to have a hearing. Because until it has that, it can't even move toward a vote. And regardless of which, I don't think this is a political issue at all. I just heard Holly Harris, who's, you know, I mean, she's with the Justice Action Network, and she's, you know, I would consider her to be about as conservative can be. But on this issue, we're 100% in lockstep, even though I'm kind of a lefty. And I know a lot of people, you know, this is not a right-left issue. This is a human dignity issue.
No question. I mean, I'm almost befuddled at the thought that there would be anyone who would argue that women wouldn't be entitled to these very basic, sensible, critical rights. It's the idea that Grassley's office, or Chuck Grassley, would be standing in the way of this getting a hearing is incredibly disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like even if it gets to the administration's desk and they don't want to sign it, then we'll worry about that then.
Right.
You know, but, you know, let's get it to where, you know, it's at least moving. It gets a chance.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of women in the system, and the idea that they don't have these things guaranteed, how is that helpful, and how does it make the, you know, the outcomes of prisons better? How does it make how does not doing any of this make us safer?
Yeah, it's so perplexing that there would even be anyone who would take that position. I'd almost like to invite anyone to contact us to help us understand where
yeah.
they'd be coming from.
And, you know, I mean, you're always welcome to do that. We do extensive show notes on my blog on Pirate Satellite. You can always leave comments there. I think most people probably know that I'm on social media a lot. If you write me at Joshua, my Twitter handle is at Joshua B. Ho. You can get a hold of me there. You know, obviously, I'm not going to probably respond if you're being, you know, unkind or rude, but I'll certainly, even if you disagree with me, I think most people who have seen me on there know that I'll engage with almost anybody and try to have a productive conversation about these things. You know, that said, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me why it hasn't moved. It just seems politically cruel, if nothing else. You know, even if you are dug in your silo, I mean, to me, this has nothing to do with silos. And I am a lefty, but my parents are both Reagan Republicans. It's not like I'm a hostile to people in that way.
So, getting back to the Day of Empathy, did we want to touch on the clean slate provisions?
I think we're going to do, when we get to reentry stuff, kind of a whole series of things on different proposals for reentry. But just to give people an idea of what it is, right now, in a lot of places, there are very complicated means of getting your record expunged. Often the only people who can get their records expunged are very limited categories of people. The vast majority of people can't get their records officially expunged even after 20, 25, 30 years. And the idea is, the research seems to overwhelmingly suggest that after 10 years, most people's risk to society, 10 years of crime-free, people's risk to society drops well below even other people in the population in many cases. And so after that period of time, the idea is that people's records should get cleared automatically. And that doesn't mean that law enforcement doesn't have access to your records, but it means that the public wouldn't have access to, you know, be able to like your employers or whatever, or background check, people wouldn't have as easy access to your.
Yeah, and thereby remove a few barriers to full participation and integration with the culture, right?
Yeah.
So is there anything else we want to touch on?
Yeah, I mean, just one other issue that I think parents and women in prison really are dealing with right now, and I'm just going to talk about it real quickly, is there's this drug called Suboxone, and the company that makes it in these strips that can be put almost anywhere. And so it's really made it almost impossible for people in prison to get mail, because the prisons are having such a hard time dealing with Suboxone strips that they've changed the rules for how mail is sent. And if you're a parent, especially if you're a parent, for every prisoner this is true, mail really makes a difference.
Right.
And but if you're a parent in particular, you know, for instance, kids can't send parents cards in Michigan.
No.
You know, they can't send them, you know, their things that they've decorated or things that they, and the reasons for that's because people can hide this Suboxone strips. Now, I mean, obviously the thing that I would really love to happen is for this company that generates Suboxone to stop making the strips.
Right.
That would be the best thing. I mean, obviously, another thing is for the departments of correction across the country to start centralizing their mail so that they can run it all through one machine that would check it for Suboxone.
Right.
Right now, they kind of do it decentralized in most states, yeah. And so you end up, they don't have the capacity to have those machines at every single facility.
Yeah, gosh, a parent should be able to receive a card from their child.
Yeah, and I mean, even when we were making Christmas cards for inmates this year at MCCD, we had this list of things we had to do. It was so hard to do it and get it. It's very hard.
Well, Josh, the National Day of Empathy, just that name, carries a connotation that I resonate with, and the idea that we would make time to find a way to become a more empathetic culture, and in particular towards a population that I think a lot of us don't take enough time to find empathy around. And it's so important. I feel like this has been one of the most affecting conversations that we've had for me in my experience, because it's so hurtful to think of the things, of these basic dignities being denied women, parents, humans, you know?
Very well put, Joel. It is a huge thing, and we really need to make sure that women are a big part of criminal justice reform, and parents too. I mean, there's probably nothing harder. I was lucky that I didn't have kids when I was in prison.
So I want to thank
you. I don't have kids now either, but you know.
For your participation and leadership in this, it's I'm heartened and encouraged that you're going to be right there, sitting across the desk from our legislators, and you'll be traveling with wishes and encouragement and hopefulness from me that, and I'm sure many of our listeners, that that they're able to hear your thoughtful, heartfelt words.
Thanks, Joel. And, you know, I hope everyone will at least give their congressperson a call or write them or send them an email or something saying that they need to ask Chuck Grassley why he hasn't gotten the Dignity Act out of his committee yet.
Absolutely.
All right. The Decarceration Nation podcast is available on iTunes, and also now, and this, I'm kind of excited about this, we're now on Spotify.
Woohoo!
Yeah, so we're available in lots of stuff, and hope you'll continue to listen, and thanks so much. Talk to you soon.